Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday, the 23rd of June. I hope you all had a lovely weekend, given the circumstances and what was swirling around in the world. And it's very, very hot today. It's going to be very, very hot tomorrow. And please take care of yourself. And a lot of schools are closed and businesses are closed and things are closed. And just heed those warnings, please. And just, you know, stay home, sit in front of a fan or an air conditioner, listen to the radio, do what you need to do.
Except if you're in Albany. There's a primary. There's very important primaries going on tomorrow.
And I'm sure you can find a way to get in
and be
air conditioned and get in and out and do your civic duty. It was a lot. I was I went to see Mumford and Sons at SPAC on Saturday night, and we were sitting there. And I'll allow them to be anonymous because I have not asked. I don't know if they have approved this story, but we had two panelists in the audience and a couple of rows in front and behind me, and about 8:30. My phone dinged and said that we had struck Iran. And then I just instinctively turned to them. I said, check your phone. And they're like, so, yeah. And so there we are. We have a lot to talk about this morning. We will do exactly that. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We are thrilled this morning, I'll tell you, because we have a great group to talk about the issues that we need to talk about. And I'm very happy to have we have a newbie in the group, and we couldn't be more happy. You're here on a very good day for us as far as helping us make sense of what is going on. Robert Brigham joins us, professor of history and international relations at Vassar College. He is a specialist on the history of U.S. foreign policy. Ding, 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 you win. Good morning, Robert. What a great pleasure.
Good morning, Joe. It's good to be here. Thank you.
It's really nice to have you here. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Jim, you know Bob.
I do, through, you know, Bart is near Vassar, and I think that's how we initially met, but a few years ago had him do a book event for a book he had written at the time on Kissinger at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs in New York City, and it was co-sponsored by Bard, and it was a hugely successful event, and so I'm just absolutely thrilled that he's now part of the roundtable.
As are we. Jim Ketter is the voice you just heard, senior fellow, Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Always nice to have you here. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. It seems like it's been a while since I've seen you, and
it has
know why.
Been. Yeah. It has been. Well,
we had the fun drive.
We had Memorial Day, and we had the fun drive. And
here we are.
And here we are.
Well, that's all right. And then you're not going to keep us down. Here we are.
Right. Here we are.
It's good to see you.
Thank you. It's lovely
welcome.
To be here.
Wonderful to have you all on the program. Again, if you'd like to be a part of the program, all you have to do is write to us, panel at WAMC.org. So we talk about the big story, of course, which is military action and the decision by the Trump administration to strike Iran, and that decision finalized on Saturday afternoon. So there's a lot to talk about in this regard, and we have identified a couple of different issues that I thought we would go to. They're probably very much overlapping, but I'll try to keep them a little bit separate if possible. So we begin with just sort of an update where the IDF expands the scope of attacks, and Trump raises the prospect of regime change in Iran. The Israel Defense Forces launched an unprecedentedly powerful strike Monday against an expanded set of targets across Iran. The Israeli Defense Ministry said, as nations across the Middle East brace for the possibility of a wider war. Iran is weighing its response to U.S. strikes on three Iranian nuclear facilities and said at an emergency meeting of the U.N. Security Council that it reserved the right to defend itself against, quote, blatant U.S. aggression. President Donald Trump, who is slated to meet with his national security team this afternoon, raised the prospect of regime change in Tehran, undercutting the messaging from his top officials. He also continued to claim substantial damage to the nuclear facilities. However, there really is no additional evidence. The International Atomic Energy Agency continues to assess the damage. The Pete Hegseth, speaking yesterday, did seem to also downplay perhaps the amount of damage that was caused, which was different from what President Trump had said on Saturday night, where it was completely obliterated, I believe were the words that he used. So that seems like a fine place to start on this Monday morning of a very brief overview of this military action. So we'll throw you into the fire. You prefer Bob?
Bob, please.
Okay. We'll throw you into the fire, Bob, and ask you what you make of this.
Well, I think there's several important things that we have to keep in mind. I think that, first, Trump has succeeded in a very limited tactical operation. This was in planning for years. Trump almost couldn't contain himself and kind of gave it away a little bit on Thursday and Friday, which is why they had to go to the second set of B-2s heading over the Pacific with their transponders on. We won't know what the official damage is until a complete after action and after battle assessment is done. The fact that there was no Iranian fire aimed at any American aircraft, I think, can hint that maybe they did already move some of their centrifuges and enriched uranium before the strikes. That's something that, again, more intelligence is going to need to be played out to see how that works. I fear right now, though, that there's not any strategic thinking going on, that there was tactical success without strategic thinking. And that's never a good thing. And I also worry significantly for the 40,000 Americans that are stationed throughout the region, because if there's one thing that Iran is good at, it's at these subnational asymmetrical attacks.
So one of the issues that I want to get to in just a little bit, one of the other themes is the of those targets, the possible targets for Iran, and we'll talk about that in a second. When you talk about the two things before we go to the others here. One is in you talking about the strategic sense. Is it ever too late to get to that point? I mean, if we don't have it now, you know, how do you slowly start to bring that in where there is a strategy? Because the strikes have been made, right?
When right.
We started it. We're in it.
We're in it, and it's impossible in real time, I think, to have a grand strategy. That's something you plan out. That's something that you use your entire national security bureaucracy to come up with. The fact that the Department of Defense handed so much of this over to CENTCOM tells me, again, it's a tactical operation without a strategy behind it. Netanyahu has a strategy, and I think he was very clever in having Trump, you know, using Trump's assets, our assets, to hit his strategic goals through American tactical operations. But there's not a grand strategy here. There's no strategic outlook of what the next five steps are going to be. We're going to be in reaction, and that's never a good place to be in.
The idea of saying on Wednesday, I believe, that or Thursday, that there wouldn't be a decision for two, or giving myself 2 weeks to make a decision. And as you say, that was probably a tap on the shoulder for the Iranians to move a lot of that stuff out. I heard a term of 60%. I don't know if that's true, of how much was moved out. But how much just is that of either a strategic or a tactical error, but an error?
Well, yeah, it's definitely an error. Tactically, this was a very proficient military operation, tactically, but you always have to fall back to what's behind it. What's coming next? What's your second order, third order operations? And I worry that those things haven't been thought through. Like, where's a potential Iranian attack going to come?
Right.
We're just not thinking all the way through these things.
Jim Ketterer.
Well, I thought I would just spend a minute or so talking about how national security decisions are made, what the process generally is or should be.
And so both typical and, for want of a better term, textbook.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about how it should happen.
Okay.
And when I was in graduate school, I took a class with the former national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski. That was a long time ago. And he ran this class like it was an NS National Security Council, and we had to go through the decision-making process. No one could have been more surprised when a year later I found myself working at the National Security Council during the Clinton administration, and so saw it up close. And I was thinking to kind of think through the process, if it's possible. It's not easy with Donald Trump, but if it's possible, just kind of take him out of the equation for a minute and just imagine the conversation with generic President X. And the people, I think, in the room, many of them would be saying, you know, Mr. President, you have a unique window of opportunity here. The Iran's regional proxies have largely been neutralized or killed off. And, you know, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and who had been working in Syria, the Shiite militias in Iraq, the Hamas. So you have them on the back foot. The Houthis, not neutralized. One thing that has fallen off the headlines is that our actions through the Biden administration and now through the Trump administration have not been successful. And I'll circle back to that because that's could be potentially important. Iran's air defenses are really degraded. Their military and scientific leadership, many of them have been killed. The religious leadership, the mullahs, many of them are in hiding. So these advisors would be saying to this president, you have this opportunity to deliver a massive blow that would ideally set back the Iranian nuclear program for many, many years. And also, you might have an opportunity to create such instability within Iran that it would topple the regime. They'll say our regional allies publicly will be wringing their hands, but behind the scenes, they'll be very happy to see Iran take this on the chin. And they would be very happy to see this revolutionary regime that has been toxic around the region to perhaps go away. And many of the Iranian people also would feel this way. But this is where we have to bring Donald Trump back in, because I think in that room when this decision is being made, you also need to have people who are thinking strategically, people who can talk through various options, pros and cons of each option, and who can speak in an unvarnished way to the president and to the leadership around the table, the principals, and to say, you know, there are many issues here and things that could go wrong. Number one, Mr. President, this will be a violation of international law. This is not a preemptive war. This is not an imminent threat. There's no intelligence that said it was an imminent threat. In fact, the intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard herself, said the opposite. So it's a preventive war, which is a violation of international law. Now, I don't know if anybody in the room would care about that so much anymore. It seems rather quaint these days. Then there's the issue of Congress. And I think we'll get to this issue in Congress later. We also won't know ahead of time, and we still don't know if these attacks have been successful or not. And in fact, with the Iranian people, it might have the opposite effect. It might have this rally round the flag kind of effect and have them support a regime that they've generally detested for a long time. And then this gets to a thing that Bob was talking about that I think is important, is the likely responses. And they should be saying this very clearly to the president that, you know, number one, the U.S. does not have a good track record in the U.S. of matching aspirations to actual capacity. And so the Iranians, for whatever their challenges are, they still have capacity to do some bad things. They have missiles and drones, and we can see this on display. They also have the capacity to shut down the Straits of Hormuz, at least for a while, to disrupt it so much that it's going to be highly problematic. And back to the Houthis, the other side in the Bab al-Mandab and coming out of the Red Sea, have the Houthis ramp up. If you shut down both of those waterways, I mean, there's still no commercial traffic going through the Red Sea anyway. You shut down the Straits of Hormuz and in and out of the Persian Gulf.
Which as of now has been shut down, right?
They're talking about it.
That was the announcement.
I think a lot of commercial traffic is, they're also saying, well, we're not going through there.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the map, that's a very tight squeeze. And then also attacks. So Bob mentioned the number of, I think, military personnel who are based in the region. We also have a lot of diplomatic personnel around the region. And I can say from my own personal experience, I've worked for American institutions in the region, of which there are many that are very soft targets. We have a cluster of American universities in Qatar. By the way, I think this morning the U.S. Embassy in Qatar was in a lockdown situation. All those universities. We have NYU has university in Abu Dhabi. You have American universities in Cairo and in Beirut. You have NGOs. We were dealing with very serious security situations when I was in these places on a normal day. And so that's really a real issue. And then the last thing I would say about the response is...
It's about 45 seconds.
Okay. What signal does this send for other countries that would like to get or thinking about getting nuclear weapons? The signal could well be get them sooner rather than later. It has the opposite effect, perhaps, potentially, that, you know, if you have a nuke, you can get love letters from Donald Trump. If you don't have a nuke, you get bombed.
We'll take a 3-minute break, and that'll be the palate cleanser to have everyone be ready for Libby's remarks, and then we'll continue the conversation. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We're already getting quite a few, so please keep them short and to the point, and we'll get to as many as we can. Panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We talk about the president's decision to strike Iran over the weekend and having many different points being made. We welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Just heard from Jim Ketter, a senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, and from earlier from Robert Brigham, a professor of history and international relations at Vassar College. Libby Post up next.
Oh, it's my turn now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I think what this is...
I just pulled your number.
Go ahead. Okay, fine, thanks. I think what this is basically, look at this shiny object over here. Look, I'm bombing Iran, and Iran is our enemy, and pay attention to that so that people aren't paying attention to the big, beautiful bill that's going to decimate people's lives, so they're not paying attention to renaming all of the army bases, like the one that was named here for Henry Johnson, for a Confederate general. Doing all the different things that they're doing. We're going to talk about Roe maybe a little later on, but also all of Project 2025 coming true under this administration. To me, this is a way for both of them, Bibi and Donald, to show their virility, but also to stay out of jail, right? They're both facing possible jail time when they are no longer in their positions, and this is a way of staying out of jail. And I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, I understand why Trump would think that this was a good thing to do tactically from an international politics point of view and all that, because Iran is seen as such a threat. But here we have Israel doing its thing to continue its war, right, which many of us feel is enough already, right? We just enough. What's going on in Gaza right now, it's atrocities. I will never go as far as to say it's genocide, right? But I will say it's atrocities. It shouldn't be happening any longer. The Palestinian people don't want Hamas, but there's no democracy there to replace to be able to do that. But you know, Netanyahu needed to do this in order to strengthen his position and try and knock out Iran, which I don't think they're going to do. And I think Trump is like, well, he did it, so I should do it. And you look, you know, watch Hegseth. He doesn't really know what he's talking about. You know, none of them really know what they're talking about. They don't have the depth of foreign affairs and military affairs bench that they need in this administration to be able to really make these dire decisions. You know, when we went after the guy from Iraq.
Saddam Hussein,
thank you. I'm thinking the other guy. But when we went after Saddam Hussein, there was a lot of planning that went into that. There was a lot of brain power. There was people on the Joint Chiefs who knew what they were doing. All of this.
Well, it was pretty misguided.
Yeah.
Brain power too.
Yes. But yes. But we
it's
all
a whole
watched.
Nother show.
Yeah, but we all watched and saw it. And yes, it was the aftermath of the Bush war on Iraq. And I get that. But at least there were people who understood what they were doing. I do not think these people really understand what they're doing, other than the pure politics of it, which is pay attention to this so you don't see what I'm doing domestically.
I just want to say too, as part of that too, I mean, even if you did know what you're doing, just imagine being the staff member who tries to prep the president to come out and give this announcement, and then he gives this freewheeling announcement. And this is the kind of situation where words really matter.
Yes.
How you say it, what you say it, how you frame it. And, the posting, he's saying things that are contradictory to his aides about regime change.
He's lying.
Whether it's war or not, they've on message that it's war, and he's saying it's not war, and it is. He said that these places were, as you said, Joe, totally obliterated, but then he said there's lots of other targets to go after.
Right.
He said the program was destroyed, and yet we might have more coming. Apparently behind the scenes, they had signaled to the Iranians, this is a one-off. But then he's saying publicly, we're going to bring more. And also in that announcement, he said, I look at this quote, I just want to say, we love you, God. And so, I mean, you know, presidents traditionally will, God bless America, God bless
America.
Our troops,
yeah,
et cetera.
But it's not like we love you.
But it must be really a white knuckle ride to try to prep somebody like that.
So let's talk about some of these issues. Did you want to say something?
Well, no, I just think, you know, nobody can prep this man. That's part of the problem. He doesn't listen to anybody. He thinks he knows everything there is to know about everything. And he's as ignorant as they come. And so he'll just do whatever he wants to do.
To what Jim was saying earlier, you see him reading the teleprompter, and you said, you know, we made these attacks. And then there's just that pause, and you see his eyes just say, attacks like no one has ever seen before, you know, and
yeah,
you're like, oh, you know, yeah. Obliterated, completely obliterated. And then it's when he starts to go off just by three or four words that things words mean things, and this is mm-hmm. obviously understatement of the year, mm-hmm. can be concerning. So let's you brought up two issues, one being the fact about war powers. Are we at war? And the other about the use of the term regime change, which mm-hmm. he's now backing away from the president, saying he just brought it up as a possible question. So let's do war powers first, because before he ordered strikes against Iran's nuclear facilities, he did not seek permission from Congress, and to which the U.S. Constitution grants the sole power to declare war. Many Democrats, many Republicans even, say that the attack was tantamount to a declaration of war and that Mr. Trump acted illegally. Several Trump aides say they disagree, calling the strike a limited action aimed solely at Iran's nuclear capabilities that does not meet the definition of war. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said on Sunday, this is not a war against Iran. So, Bob, what is it?
Well, it isn't a war yet, but it is hostilities, and the War Powers Resolution doesn't talk about war, believe it or not. It talks about hostilities. And there's a context to that. The War Powers Resolution, 1973, is on the back of repealing the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution from August 1964, which gave Lyndon Johnson a blank check to fight in Vietnam. Congress finally woke up and decided to claw some of their constitutional responsibility back. So they passed the War Powers Resolution. I actually think, and I hate to say this out loud, but I actually think Trump's on firmer ground here than he is on the strategy and what's going to happen next in the region. The way the War Powers Resolution reads, he has 48 hours to consult and to have the DOG lawyers consult with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He also has to notify the Speaker of the House and the Senate Pro Tem. That's been done. They have meetings tomorrow. So constitutionally, I don't think there's a court that would take this. The president then has 60 days. The Congress has to put forward a war powers resolution within 24 of those 60 days. Unlike other bills, it has to be voted on. I think the time is 3 days. They have to bring it forward. So I know AOC and others are saying this is an impeachable offense. I think that's a street that goes nowhere. I think they ought to focus more on the next steps and focus on what the United States is going to do next than looking clearly at this constitutional issue. I don't think there's a court in the land that would land this in a war powers violation.
I mean, I think that if you look at the sort of the longer arc of this, post-World War II, which is the last time the Congress officially declared war, you know, you see this this tension that's built in between Article I of Congress and Congress's powers in Article II and the presidential powers, that it has Democrats and Republicans have brought all kinds of power into the White House in terms of this stuff. And I think Bob's absolutely right that it's a dead end in terms of the law in trying to stop this. It's maybe not a dead end for Democrats in terms of the politics mm-hmm. to bring it up, right. Which, you know, Libby knows a lot more about than I do. But this, you know, there is a reason, though, that you see both Netanyahu and Trump in his own way, you know, trying to say that this was an imminent threat. And, you know, that is also is key. I mean, it's because if it's an imminent threat and you have to act right away, that's one thing. If it's not imminent, number one, as I said before, that's highly problematic in terms of international law. Number two, there would have been time in such a circumstance to do something that's vague in the War Powers Resolution. What does it mean to consult Congress and to do something that was more fully articulated and to really have serious conversations about what to do? And so presidents tend to not like to do that. It slows things down. They've already decided what they want to do, and information leaks out, which can be highly problematic.
I think the politics side of this is really interesting. I mean, Tim Kaine's already said he's going to introduce the war resolution. That just opens the debate, and I think he wants to force a vote because then you can see the fissures in the MAGA world, which is, I think, the political part of this that Jim's talking about. That's really more interesting on the War Powers Act side is what is this going to do to that base? Is Trump clearly ran on the program that he would never go to war in the Middle East.
And accused everybody else of going to war in the Middle East. If Kamala had gotten elected, we'd be in a war within 6 months. Well, I think he made the 6 months. He was sworn in January 20th. It's now June 23rd, so we got a little bit. You know, he did what he said he was going to do, or what he said everyone else was going to do, which is exactly what they always do. You know, he makes somebody else look like they're bad because they're going to do X, Y, and Z, and then he goes ahead and does it himself or has been doing it. You know, it's this projection that they are very adept at. And so it just keeps everybody off their game. My question is, I mean, everything we read saying, you know, they can strike out in the bases that we have in the Middle East, you know, to strike back. They don't have the capability of missiles coming here. Will we have a draft now? Will Trump bring this to the point where we'll have boots on the ground, especially if he wants to do a regime change? What's that going to look like? And I haven't heard talk of regime change really seriously since before I was born, when Nixon went to South America all the time.
Well, but, Iraq.
You know, Iraq, yeah. Right. But, I mean,
Libya.
You know, it's like they want the regime change here to control the oil. It all comes down to economic interests.
I think the regime change thing is interesting from something that Jim said earlier, and that is, at this point, for the foreseeable future, I don't think it really matters, because the message that Iranian leadership got, no matter who it is we have to get a nuclear weapon quick. We can't ever be this vulnerable again. We're going to go underground. This might take us 2 decades, and that's a far more dangerous scenario than we're going to meet again next month in Oman.
Yeah, and let's also... You make me think of something, Bob. Let's remember why we're here specifically on Iran and nuclear weapons. That in 2018, in Trump 1, Donald Trump decided to rip up the agreement that had been concluded in the Obama administration, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, which was not a perfect treaty by any means. However, it worked in various ways to at least mitigate Iran's ability to get nuclear weapons. And the right has been very upset because, you know, the funds were released, the Iranian funds were released, some sanctions were lifted, et cetera. But the monitoring, the inspections, the reduction in centrifuges, in enriched uranium, et cetera, this was all real, and it was all happening. And so to say, okay, we're going to back out of this treaty with no good explanation as to, number one, why, and no plan B, no strategic thinking as to what to do.
It was a DEI treaty. You know that. That's all it was. It was a DEI treaty.
We have to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about the other issue that we mentioned, and that is regime change. And then we'll take a break, and then at the top of the hour, and then we'll go to your letters, and there are many of them. So, a lot to get to. We will be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Libby Post, Jim Ketterer, Bob Brigham here this morning, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll get to those letters on the other side of a news break at the top of the hour. The other issue I wanted to talk about, so we have not everything, but a lot of things on the table to talk about and for people to respond to, and that is what we have been bringing up a couple of times in regards to regime change. And I guess I'm interested, since you started this, Jim, of giving us the context of what is how should regime, like, what is that? What, when we say what is regime change, what would be the definition of that?
Well, I think it's useful to look at examples that have happened at via U.S. military action. And so we don't need to just kind of speculate, well, what if this ever happened? We have examples in the not too distant past of when it has happened. I mean, Iraq is probably the most notorious fiasco in which this happened. And Libya also was one that started off that wasn't supposed to be regime change and then turned into regime change. And Libya is still in an absolute catastrophic mess. And so I used to be the director of a center that worked on projects that after 9/11 ended up coming into places like Iraq and Afghanistan and amidst these regime changes. And I saw with my own eyes the absolute chaos that unfolds, the unintended consequences that are released, and the inability of the United States, despite all of its massive military power, despite all of its resources that it could bring to bear, to be able to engineer the outcome that they want. I don't think anybody could look at Iraq and Afghanistan and say those were successful regime changes. The regimes changed, but were they successful from the interests of the United States? Were they successful from the interests of many people in Afghanistan and Iraq? I would certainly say not. And so there are so many unintended consequences. And just by dint of the U.S. doing it and being involved in it, it is almost certain that even people who are kind of predisposed to like the United States in general will not like the United States interfering in their internal politics. So, I mean, Iranians, I would say, many of them would like to have their regime go away. Many of them would like to be more tied to the West. That doesn't necessarily translate into they would like the United States to bomb their country into regime change and to force it militarily. And also, I've lived in places where they've had, not by dint of the United States, but on their own, they've had a massive change in government, and they've ended up with worse, substantially worse. So there's a lot of moving parts on this. And as Bob said, without the kind of lack of sober analysis and strategic thinking, I think it's extremely dangerous.
So when it comes to sober analysis, the president tweeted or truth socialed a few moments ago that says, everyone keep oil prices down. I'm watching. What can he do?
Nothing.
Not much. I mean, I think the Russians clearly are excited about the Strait of Hormuz being shut today because it's going to drive their price per barrel way up. Can I go back to one thing that Jim said about regime change? One time that the United States was involved where it was somewhat successful was Milosevic in Serbia. Mm. And that was because we brought in allies, mostly NATO bombing. It was his own people who turned him into the ICC, the International Criminal Court. And to me, what's really interesting about this attack on Iran is how unilateral it was. It starts from American soil outside of Kansas City and St. Louis. You know, it did not involve NATO allies at all. Even part of the ruse was involving NATO allies. NATO meets starting tomorrow. The Brits went online today and said that they supported this initial strike. But I don't think they're going to be in for regime change for all the reasons Jim met. It's unpredictable. It's messy. It's sloppy. It rarely works.
The term that you hear attached to it so often is forever war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, I mean, the number one it brings to mind Colin Powell's Pottery Barn theory. You break it, you buy it. It's yours. And so when you break it and you break a large, complex society like Iran, and after all these decades of authoritarian theocratic rule, it's going to break into so many difficult pieces. And the other Colin Powell, I think it was Colin Powell who said the most often unasked question in Washington, and then what? And like, so, you know, to try to think a few steps ahead, mm-hmm. as Bob was saying, I don't have any confidence that's happening.
The echoes of Iraq here are overwhelming to me. I mean, Bremer, who was in charge of rebuilding Iraq after regime change, famously said, it doesn't matter who takes out the garbage on Tuesday. But it does matter who takes out the garbage on Tuesday. Yeah. There are 90 million people mm-hmm. living in Iran. And if you do take this to the next step, nation building is very difficult to do. It is incredibly difficult. We haven't had a great track record doing it.
And I was, I have to say, I was involved in it and it didn't work. We also, most Americans don't remember this, but every Iranian remembers this. The United States was already involved in regime change in Iran in 1953 when we and the Brits engineered a coup d'etat against a democratically elected leader. The coup d'etat, which was engineered by Kermit Roosevelt and Miles Copeland, and put the Shah back in place, who then carried out, you know, a very brutal regime. It was no mistake and no kind of random thing that we ended up being known as the Great Satan when the revolution happened in Iran in the late 70s.
Let's pause there. When we come back, we'll get into listener letters, which will bring us into a lot of different directions as well. Still much to discuss about this issue, and we will do exactly that. We'll take a break. First, a few messages and news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable on this Monday, the 23rd of June. We, of course, are talking about the U.S. military strike in Iran, and we have a terrific panel. Bob Brigham is with us, professor of history and international relations at Vassar College. He's a specialist on the history of U.S. foreign policy. Jim Ketter joins us, senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, and political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post with us as well. We do have letters, so let's get to as many as we can on this morning. And we welcome yours as well, by the way, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Richard writes to us, timestamp 10:01. Rather than skipping ahead to the subject of regime change, could the panel take a second and consider the number of responses that could be made by the current Iranian government and how our administration might react to those?
I think I mentioned quite a few of potential responses.
Yeah, I think the idea that they're going to immediately go to negotiations is not one of them. They could decide to go underground with their nuclear program and speed it up.
Yeah, I mean, if it wasn't totally obliterated, as the president said, or if they had moved things ahead of time, as many suspect. But, you know, so on the use of missiles and drones, or if there's some proxy attacks or terrorist attacks somewhere, this is not based on anything other than just a hunch that the Iranian regime, which is in a pretty weak position now, that they are not inclined, they're inclined to respond, but not to escalate. And so I think you'll probably see something that's calibrated and to send a message to their own people and to others, we're not giving up, we're not going to go to the negotiating table, but we also don't want to, you know, give justification for some kind of massive U.S. response.
I think those two things are actually tied. If they have a response but not an escalation, that I think also tips their hand that they have a longer strategy in mind, that they're going to take this to the nuclear realm. They're going to take that 60% enriched uranium and they're going to go with it underground, completely underground, and have a decades-long plan.
Yeah, I agree.
We have this from Dave, who said it would bring another country into the war, but not necessarily add that much additional capacity, especially relative to the United States entering. But it seems to me that one of the most effective targets for the Iranians to attack and inflict the greatest harm on the West would be the oil terminal complexes in Saudi Arabia and other adjacent oil exporters. The retaliation against Iran would be immense, with the destruction of the West would really be harmful, throwing the world in the recession or depression in the short run, but also help Russian allies by raising the price of their oil exports. That from Dave.
Yeah, I don't think they'll do that. But I do think they'll, on and off, will close the Straits of Hormuz.
But it does, and it does raise the issue, and I think we said this in the break, about what Russia's going to do. Because they've got an agreement, some sort of security agreement with Iran. And so what are they going to do?
And their oil doesn't need to come through the Straits of Hormuz.
Yeah, right. I know their oil doesn't, but will they come?
Money.
Yeah. Will they come to Iran's aid? Will they get engaged in this this play that's we're in the middle of?
While this is all going on, the Russians have really ramped up operations in Ukraine. They're heavily involved in that. They didn't come to the aid of Assad in Syria.
Right.
I don't think they're going to come to much aid of the Iranians. I mean, I think Putin has said a few, this is bad for the world or something like that. But I don't think they're likely to do that. But while everybody is looking the other way,
right,
they are doubling down in Ukraine.
Yeah. And if you think that there hasn't been conversations around that because this is Putin's shiny object, right, I'm sure there have been.
Catherine writes to us and says, is it possible that Bibi stepped up his strikes on Iran based on Trump giving the go-ahead for the B-2s?
I think it's more likely the other way around. My sense of this is that Israel has had this strategy, as Jim outlined earlier, you know, Hamas, Hezbollah, and taking out any air defenses. I mean, Israel had air superiority. That is one thing about the imminent threat that will come up in those hearings in Congress and the Foreign Relations Committee. Imminent threat can be also perceived in a war powers resolution process that you have air superiority for a very short period of time, and that this is the moment. So I think Israel has Netanyahu has had this strategic outlook and borrowed some B-2s to get something done.
We go to Marianne. If indeed we hit the targets and there was radioactive materials there, one would expect some of it to become airborne and measurable downwind. Do we have any reports of elevated levels? Not that we're aware of.
I haven't heard any reports. And I think what is included in these targets is not just radioactive nuclear material, but the entire nuclear infrastructure, all of the sensitive equipment and the pieces that are required. And this isn't, by the way, the first time that there have been attacks on this infrastructure. The attacks have been in other ways. There was the Stuxnet operation, which was done by Israel with assistance from others, and assuming the U.S. as well, although never really formally admitted. And that was done through an operation where, through a thumb drive, something was introduced into the system, and the centrifuges basically just spun off and destroyed themselves. But it's that kind of infrastructure. So I'm not sure about the specific question on radioactive material and what would be measurable and what wouldn't. I mean, I think, you know, given how deep these things have been buried, I think the damage assessment must be difficult to carry out.
They're 360 feet below the ground, and the B-2 explodes, the bomb of the B-2 explodes at 200 feet. So.
back to the letters, and we check in with, as soon as I find the letters again, I will check in. There we go. We check in with Ed. Today's panel seems focused solely on the problematic aspects of the U.S. strike on Iranian nuclear sites. Indeed, many of those concerns are valid. However, you are overlooking the bigger historic picture. Progression on development of an Iranian nuclear weapon has been abruptly disrupted, if not halted. This is crucial for the region's balance of power and safety, and probably worth the numerous risks you cite. The world does not need another rogue nuclear power like North Korea.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the listener wasn't listening or I wasn't clear, but I tried to say at the beginning when we kind of walked through that scenario about how national security decisions are made that the people in the room undoubtedly would have been saying, Mr. President, you have this opportunity, that this is a bad regime. We don't want them to make nuclear weapons. And for all of these reasons, you have this window of opportunity that won't stay open for long. And so with any of these kinds of decisions, there are pros and there are cons. And there are risks and rewards. If they were easy decisions, they would have already been made. So, I mean, I agree with the letter writer. I think we addressed some of that, but I'm not always clear. So.
Sometimes people are just joining us late. That's fine. We're here when you get to us. That's fine. All right. Let's go back to other letters that we have from our listeners. Panel, Iran got pummeled. They are no longer a factor. If you think they have 60% uranium deposits, you're crazy. They're one bad decision away from becoming a parking lot with only refugees left. Trump did the right thing. Take Iran off the nuclear table. Thanks, Sean from Cambridge.
But did he really take them off the nuclear table? The answer to that is no. They'll find a way. I mean, their hatred of the West is really pretty clear, and they'll find a way. And they also now see themselves as the victim in all of this because Israel bombed, then we bombed. So they're gonna keep doing this. And if these bunker bombs only go 200 feet down and they're at 3-something, you know, you wonder if it really impacted. So here's my question. If they send two bombs, one right after another, and one's 200 feet down, when the other one hits, would that go another 200?
They explode at 200.
Oh, they explode at 200. Okay.
I just want to say I take some issue with the language of that letter. I think if we're talking about another country and we're talking about reducing it to a parking lot and creating a mass outflow of refugees, what you're talking about, what you're hoping for is a collective punishment against an entire people for the actions of a regime. I am no fan of the Iranian regime, and this has definitely been a toxic presence in the Middle East and in the world for a long time. But I think we need to be exceedingly careful that we don't end up punishing others who have nothing to do with that and, in fact, could be actually quite predisposed to be also getting rid of that regime.
Great point. Thank you. Let's go to another letter and check in with Jeremy, who wants to know, are the panelists in favor of Iran having a nuclear bomb?
I'm not sure I get a vote in this in any kind of international forum, but no, I don't think an Iranian nuclear weapon is good for international security. I would have favored not backing out of the 2015 agreement as Trump did in 2018, and seeing and granted Iran violated. From 2019 on, violated the International Atomic Energy Agency's protocols repeatedly. But it looked like there might have been a chance to reopen this. We were actively engaged in negotiations. Negotiations were scheduled again. I know it's been a bit of a cat and mouse game, but I'd rather have an Iran in the process where you have some control over events than an Iran where you don't know where their process is at all. And that's what frightens me about this entire episode, is that the lack of immediate response suggests that the uranium was moved, centrifuges were moved, that the program is going to survive this. It's just going to take a lot longer.
Yeah, I mean, I think I certainly don't think that it's a good idea for the Iranians to have a nuclear weapon. But as Bob was saying, it's just a question of, so how do you manage this complex situation? I would say more broadly, too, I do think it is healthy for people to take this moment and also understand that when the Cold War ended and when we were on the nuclear brink time and again during that period, that danger did not go away when that Cold War ended. And I think for many people, they thought, well, we dodged that bullet and that's over. And that is definitely not the case. And by the estimation of many people who are truly experts in this area of nuclear policy, they would say that as bad as the Cold War was and as dangerous as it was, we live in a more dangerous nuclear world now because we have so many other moving parts. We have such an inability to kind of have rules of the game that we largely had, not entirely, in the Cold War. So wherever people stand on this particular Iranian issue, I do think it's healthy to kind of just re-engage on this issue of nuclear weapons writ large. And, you know, when Obama first took office, his very first international speech, which got no attention at all, was on nuclear weapons. He came into office saying he wanted to do a lot on it, and he really ended up being thwarted and not doing a lot and just not focusing on it in the same kind of way, although there was the Iran deal, which was one major thing. But generally, globally, I think people just do not have a focus on it.
Yeah, I don't think anybody should have nuclear bombs. I mean, you know, it's a weapon of war that is of such massive devastation, and we saw what happened in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. We saw what happens when those bombs go off, that there nobody should have it. And I know that that's sort of pie in the sky because we're going to have them. You know, we are going to have them, unless you think differently.
I don't think it's pie in the sky.
Oh, good.
You know, I worked with a lot of policymakers like Jim did over the years. Robert McNamara was one. He was totally for zero nukes. There are a lot of people who've been in that seat who had to make those decisions who support going to zero nuclear weapons. It's just, how do you get there? There's no infrastructure to get there right now.
And you know, Libby, one person who would have agreed with you in that statement is Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who?
Yeah, tear down that wall. I mean,
and not just tear down the wall.
I mean,
on nukes itself.
Yeah.
I mean, he.
Right. I mean, it's... The issue is, while we may not, those of us who remember, agree with McNamara and the Vietnam War, right? He had a brain. He was thoughtful. He went to school. These people that were in the cabinet back in the 60s and even in the 70s to some degree were thoughtful, trained, academic people who could take what they learned and put it into real-world reality, right? We're dealing with folks who never went to school, who never had any kind of real training or education in foreign affairs. You know, I don't even know if they did the UN Club when they were kids. I did. You know, I mean, we just don't have that level of gravitas in government right now. And part of it is because people like Trump has maligned government service for so long and undermined the desire to go into government and serve the public. And some of it is Fox News.
Also, I think that, you know, each president sets the tone of how much cabinet secretary is in a few levels down, how much flexibility they're going to have. And it certainly seems in this administration that's zero flexibility to have a mind of their own. I mean, I would say that, you know, based on his time in the Senate, you know, Marco Rubio does actually have a deep understanding of foreign relations. He was heavily involved, I met him when he came to Cairo in a congressional delegation.
Can he really do anything, though?
That's the thing. Does he have any flexibility to, even if it's behind closed doors, to speak up? I don't know what the answer to that is, but it seems like this is a very tightly controlled operation.
Adding to what you're saying about Rubio, which I agree that he is actually qualified for that position, but with the hollowed out State Department now and with USAID, all the kind of things that you would need in a post Iran regime world to put the pieces back together aren't there anymore. It's hollowed out. We don't have that kind of area expertise or the development expertise or any of the coordination with non-governmental organizations. It's just non-existent.
It's gone.
Just assuming that there, Tulsi Gabbard being out of the equation. I mean, okay, so there's a rift there, but don't we need
you need that person in the room,
right,
Joe?
Don't we need that job filled?
Yeah, with somebody who knows what they're doing.
Well,
that's the issue.
Okay, but.
But what?
But we also, but there's just no one in there right now. I mean, that was there's mm-hmm. no one in that position. It doesn't seem. And if she still holds that title, it's not. They're not utilizing her in any.
But she had nothing
way.
To be utilized. That's the thing. These appointments, for the most part, maybe Marco Rubio is the lone holdout here. But for the most part, these people don't know what they're doing. They don't have the expertise. You know, he put in people who supported him. This was his way of fulfilling political favors, not protecting Americans.
And, you know, we don't have to just speculate as to what happens when you don't follow the intelligence. We can see the example in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003, that there were specific actions that were taken to not listen to the intelligence that didn't agree with what they wanted to do already. And that led to a complete disaster that still has ripple effects across the Middle East, still has ripple effects, I would say, within the national security framework of the United States government as well. It was such a massive disaster. And not listening to the intelligence, cooking the data, and boxing out people that just didn't agree with you, not giving people the standing and the opportunity to voice a countering opinion, that is deadly for policymaking, literally deadly.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. It is. The best and the brightest are not who we have anymore.
Director of National Intelligence, and the rift seems to be over this is before the strike, but the concerns seem to be more centered on that she is one who is trying to capitalize and advance her own political
surprise, surprise, surprise. Come on.
But okay. Let's see. Let's get a couple more letters here. If Iran cannot develop its own nuclear weapons, is there another way for them to obtain those weapons?
They can buy it.
Yeah,
you can buy it. Enriched uranium.
Yeah, I mean the Libyans were engaged in that, there was someone from Pakistan who was basically, I can't remember the details of this case, who was basically selling both knowledge and I think materials on the open market.
Yeah.
All right. I think that is it for the letters that we have time for and that were chosen. To the point that Libby made about the present cabinet members' lack of practical knowledge regarding what we're dealing with now, we also have a president who hasn't worked a day in his life at any sort of job. The only thing he has worked at is scamming people. What do you make of that? Well, I think we know what you mean.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. We have the grifter in chief here, so...
There you go.
And he's just out for himself. He's never been out for anything else but himself. And you have to wonder if there's like good seaside property in Iran for a hotel. You just got to wonder.
All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up and move on to some other topics, and then we'll be done for the morning. My thanks to our wonderful panel as they continue with us, and we welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Again, we'll get to as many as we can. Keep them short and to the point. panel@wamc.org. We will continue after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, 10:33 on this 23rd day of June. Robert Brigham is with us, Jim Ketterer, and Libby Post. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We have about 15 minutes left with our group, so a couple of topics that I would like to get to before we move on for this morning. All right. Stop me if you've heard of any of these names before as we go deep into the time capsule. Andrew Cuomo has enlisted former President Bill Clinton as part of a late-stage bid to bolster his chances to be mayor of the city of New York. The former president's endorsement came as Letitia James, the state attorney general who supports Andrew Cuomo's mayoral rivals, criticized the former governor over harassment violations. So over the weekend, Bill Clinton endorsed Andrew Cuomo in the New York City mayor's race, giving a last-minute boost of support to Mr. Cuomo as he urged supporters to head to the polls for the last day of early voting. Mr. Cuomo worked in the Clinton administration as the housing secretary, the backing of the former president, as well as a taped robocall providing his support could help turn out older voters in the tightening Democratic mayoral primary on Tuesday, better known as tomorrow. Mr. Clinton said in the robocall that he had hired Mr. Cuomo because, quote, he knows how to get things done, and then he believed that he would, quote, stand up and protect the people of this city from President Trump. Mr. Clinton, 78, who lives in Westchester County suburb north of New York, has not often weighed in on city primary races. His endorsement is another indication that some establishment Democrats prefer Mr. Cuomo to Mr. Mamdani, a state lawmaker and Democratic socialist who is second in the polls. The endorsement came as Mr. Cuomo and his rivals attended campaign events across the city trying to convert undecided voters and to ensure that their supporters showed up at the polls. Well, maybe not this particular race, but this is your life.
Yes, it is.
Post. Yes. So what do you make of it?
Well, I'm not surprised. I mean, they have a relationship. Andrew was the HUD secretary under Clinton. Clinton, remember, it's the Democratic Leadership Council was the 90-something, right, when he became president, 92?
92.
92, right. We won, okay. Yeah.
So with the ushering in right, of his presidency and the Democratic Leadership Council, the party moved to the center, right? It really, really did. And he was, you know, work fair and all of that. So I'm not surprised that the two of them still agree on those issues and moving the party more to the center rather than to the far left. I think that Cuomo will win. I mean, I just, you know, I think it's pretty clear the writing's on the wall. This whole ranked choice voting, you know, I'm not sure exactly how it works, but you keep going. You know, if this one doesn't make it, then you go to this one and back and forth and back and forth. You know, people said, oh, we should do that here. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think so. But, you know, we have smaller races here.
Libby, I have a question.
Yes, dear.
Do endorsements matter? Do they make a difference politically?
You know, it's really, really interesting. They're nice to have, but they're not a make it or break it anymore. You know, it's like locally when you get the TU endorsement, everybody's happy. It's better than not getting it, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to win. And endorsements, because of the degradation of our body politic, right? Endorsements of former elected officials, some see that as just more corruption, right? More of the same, more, you know, same old, same old. So sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. You know, I sit on the back of a convertible at Pride with my candidate. I did it this year with Dorsey. It sends a message that she's the LGBT candidate, that we should be supporting her. You know, whether she wins from that, I don't know. I did it with Lee last year. I've done it with a lot of people. You know, but they are not as essential, but nobody doesn't not want to have them, right? You want the endorsements from the unions. You want the endorsements from former elected officials or present elected officials because it gives you credibility. So
in New York, and New York Times chief among them, Andrew Cuomo's on the front page of the paper for getting an endorsement from Bill Clinton.
That's
so that
right.
Can't
so,
be bad,
right? No, when you're passing by the newsstand, there it is. And it's probably on the Post as well as as the Daily News.
The words might be different, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I don't know how many. Well, never mind.
What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Bill was president quite a while ago. And the reason I was asking the question, in addition to just in general, do endorsements matter? That I wonder if sometimes, and Libby got to the, you know, the it can backfire on you in a way, make it just look like it's more corruption. And then there's the specifics of who's doing the endorsement and who's receiving the endorsement. And, you know, Bill Clinton and Andrew Cuomo have something in common in terms of their past, and that I would imagine would leap to the mind of many people, and it's not necessarily a positive.
Yeah.
But I guess under the heading of any news is good news, I suppose it helps the day before an election. But I don't know.
Bob?
I think the demographics say this is going to help.
Yeah.
You know, there are 4.5 million registered voters in New York, and 58% of the voting age population is between 18 and 29. But that's also the group that doesn't show up
to
vote.
Right.
The highest turnout in New York City elections are those 60 and over.
Right.
And that's this group.
Yeah.
I'm that group.
They remember Bill Clinton.
Yeah, they remember.
Yeah.
We're all.
So I think it,
yeah.
I think
maybe not Joe,
wheels.
But I think the only
of
us
are part of
that. What? You're 60 already?
No, but I remember, well, almost.
Okay.
Almost.
Yeah.
So from that standpoint, from the demographic standpoint, which is what people like Libby live on, right?
That
I think this is significant. And Clinton has a presence in New York. Property offices, he lives north of the city. I mean, it's...
And everybody liked him.
Yeah?
That's the other thing. Despite his foibles, people did like him. And so there's that. And it makes him... Maybe some of his likability will wear off on Andrew. You never know.
Maybe that's a separate question.
Yeah, that is. It's a
All
separate
right.
show, actually.
We have about 5 minutes left, so let's go to the Dobbs anniversary, where Senate Democrats are aiming to restart abortion conversation. This from the Washington Post. And the Senator Patty Murray of Washington, Democrat from Washington, says the GOP is moving toward a, quote, national abortion ban behind the scenes and hopes a staged hearing will spotlight the threat. And Patty Murray had a news conference at the Capitol last week, and now just weeks looking at this anniversary of doing this hearing, the law banned nearly all abortions in the state of Louisiana, and just weeks after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, Nancy Davis learned that her fetus had a fatal cranial condition. She sought an abortion in her home state of Louisiana, but a trigger law took effect shortly after the June 2022 decision. The law banned nearly all abortions in the state, and doctors were unsure if Davis's case fell within its few exceptions, forcing her to travel to New York to have an abortion. 3 years post-Roe, Davis worries for patients who may still face the kind of excruciating decisions about their pregnancies that she did. On Tuesday, she will help Senate Democrats, as they try to bring abortion and reproductive health back to the forefront on the anniversary of the Supreme Court's decision in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization.
Look, they don't care about women. Women are bleeding out in parking lots. They don't care. I mean, this is an administration of cruelty and chaos and corruption. And cruelty is really high up there on their list. And I think it's important for the Senate Dems to keep pushing this and as an issue as we go into the midterms. You know, they want a national abortion ban. That's what they want. And, you know, Trump has said, I'll veto it. It's a states' rights issue. I don't believe him. It's all transactional for him. So, you know, and the fact that these right-wing Christian nationalists are making him into a savior, that's what he wants. That's how he sees himself. And so I think, you know, they need to keep pushing on this issue, and we cannot let up, because it's a woman's right to control her own body, right? It's also LGBTQ people's right to control their own body. There's a lot going on here that, you know, my attitude is, okay, you're going to ban abortion? Let's ban Viagra and all of those other kinds of drugs, because it, you know, it takes two to tango here. You need sperm and the egg. And so if the guys can't do it, then oh well. But this is all about male superiority and men taking back what they see as their role as the master of the house.
I would also say that the people who decry a theocratic state in Iran are also very happy to invite religion into our own policymaking.
Right, and have one here.
Yeah.
They want, this is white Christian nationalism. And it's white supremacy.
The move comes at a time when abortion appears to have drifted away from where it once stood as a key political issue. That is a line in this Washington Post article. What happened as far as it being, it's been 3 years, and there was a lot of outrage, and now not as much.
I think everyone is tired, and you have to get rejuvenated on these issues and all the other issues at stake as well. I mean, the fact that Trump got reelected has on one hand taken the wind out of some people's sails and on the other hand re-energized. But I think all of us need to look at what we're doing, the effectiveness of it, and come together. Part of the problem is that, you know, the Democratic Party is somewhat fractured over certain issues. Not this one, though. Not this one, not gay rights, not bodily autonomy. So let's come together around this, and we can deal with the other stuff at another point. But this is about women dying. This is about women bleeding out in parking lots. And women have bled out in parking lots, and they have died. And this administration doesn't care.
All right. We'll end there. My thanks to everybody for being with us this morning. Libby, thank you as always. Good luck tomorrow.
Thank you. Have fun. Thank you.
Jim Ketter, Senior Fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Thank you very much for being here.
Great to be here.
And, oh my God, we love Bob Brigham. Thank you very much for being with us. Will you come back?
I would love to come back.
We would love to have you back. You're the best. Thank you so much for being here, Professor of History and International Relations at Vassar College. Wonderful to have you on the program, and I thank you so much. The day to have you here. So we thank you so much for being with us. We will be right back after this.